Okay, so good afternoon. This Wednesday marks the 1 year anniversary of the devastating earthquake that struck Christchurch at 12:51 on the 22nd of February 2011. This will be a time to reflect on what has been lost. Christchurch, and indeed all of New Zealand, was changed forever that day. It will be a sad day, but will also be an important part of the healing process. There is no arguing that 22nd of February 2011 will go down the history of New Zealand as one of our darkest days. The magnitude 6.3 earthquake had a huge impact on so many people from all around the world. Nationals of 14 countries died in the earthquake that day, including a large number of New Zealanders. In total, 185 people lost their lives that day, and many more were badly injured. My thoughts this week are with the friends and families of those who lost loved ones, and indeed with all the people of Canterbury who have lived through so much. Greater Christchurch has been rocked by more than 10,000 earthquakes in total since the 4th of September 2010, including 39 of a magnitude of 5 or greater. At this time, 1 year on from that tragic day, it's also important to reflect on what has been achieved over the past year in terms of the recovery of Christchurch and getting the region back on its feet. The recovery of Greater Christchurch is making good progress. Construction is underway on around 26 significant commercial buildings within the four avenues of the central city, which is one of the hardest hit in terms of earthquake damage. Around 80% of the 1,406 buildings identified by CERA and Civil Defence as required to be partially or fully demolished in Greater Christchurch due to the earthquake damage have been completed. Around 200 infrastructure repair projects valued at more than $420 million are also underway across the city. Thousands of badly damaged Canterbury homes have been repaired. All the work to repair them is now underway. The residential red zone settlement process is progressing well. There are now around 6,800 properties in the residential red zone in Canterbury, and around 46% have now formally accepted either of the government's offer options to purchase their property. More than a third have already settled on their properties, which has enabled them to move on and restart their lives. The restart, the Heart shopping area in Cashel Mall is up and running and is thriving and drawing people back to the central city. Long term, Christchurch will look much different to what it did that time ago, but it will be a vibrant, new and great place to live. But the focus on Wednesday will be to reflect on that fateful day last February and to honour those who lost their lives, those who were injured and those heroes and heroines who selflessly went to the aid of their fellow human beings. I will be heading to Christchurch this week to attend the various memorial services. I'll also be giving a short speech at the special service for local and overseas families who lost loved ones at Latimer Square on Wednesday morning. In terms of other ministerial activity, I'll be in the electorate tomorrow before travelling to Christchurch. On Thursday, I'll be in Christchurch and the Christchurch area to various activities. On Saturday, I'll be going to the Trans-Tasman Wings competition and the Helensville AMP show. One final thing. And that is, on the 7th of February, I moved a resolution in the House congratulating Her Majesty the Queen on the occasion of the Diamond Jubilee of Her Majesty's accession to the throne. Today I'm pleased to announce that New Zealand will contribute $1 million to the Queen Elizabeth Diamond Jubilee Trust, which has been established by the United Kingdom and was endorsed by the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Australia last year. Trust will be chaired by Sir John Major and will focus on enriching communities in the Commonwealth, both socially and culturally. I'm also delighted that Sir Don McKinnon has agreed to be appointed as New Zealand's eminent individual to promote the Trust in New Zealand. As a widely respected former Secretary General of the Commonwealth, Sir Don is the obvious choice for this position. I'm grateful to Sir Don for his agreement to volunteer his valuable time to take on this position. Questions?
Overwhelmingly, across the board, New Zealand is the same, that their offer was tightened, especially if you're living overseas, foreign living overseas, and buying land here. Is it something that you will take into account and perhaps a little more change?
Well, I think we need to acknowledge New Zealanders do feel very strongly about foreigners coming and buying land in New Zealand. I think that's not a new issue. I think that's been a widely held view. That's why the government moved some time ago to actually tightening up the law. I think some perspective needs to be put on that issue. In the last 18 months, notwithstanding the Crayford farms, 72 farms have been sold to foreign purchasers, and that's out of a total of about 10,000 dairy farms and 35,000 sheep and beef farms. So it's not an enormous number. It's also possible, subject to the interpretation now of Justice Miller's decision last week, that effectively a tightening of the law may well have taken place, because what is clear is that Justice Miller at least is arguing that a new perspective on that test of benefits should be interpreted by both the Overseas Investment Office and therefore guide the decision of ministers.
So if the Overseas Investment Office throws it back to the government to approve, if they give it a tick, does that therefore mean that it's a much tougher decision based on the public opinion that's out there, and would that therefore trigger some kind of review if they chuck it back to you and say approve?
No, that's not the test. I mean, the test is whether the application meets the law as it's currently prescribed in New Zealand. Now, what is true is that the Overseas Investment Office will need to seek clarification of the law. My understanding is they're doing that through a Crown Law opinion. It's also true that ministers will want to be absolutely confident they are correctly interpreting the law, and they may seek to get their own view on that. But in the end, the test will be the same as it was last time, which is, do ministers believe that Section 16 and 18 of the SOE Act, so the Overseas Investment Act, has been complied with? And if it does, then they're pretty much bound to accept that application. Now, yeah, let's see how that goes.
Well, do you think that it's a perception issue? Are you saying that New Zealanders are wrong in these polls, but they don't actually know the full picture?
No, what I'm saying is New Zealanders are answering a fairly simple question about whether they want to see it harder or easier for foreigners to buy land. What I'm saying to you is, actually, by a number of studies, New Zealand is quite a difficult place to buy land if you're a foreigner. For instance, the OECD did a study which, of the 40-odd countries they looked at, 37 of them, or 36 of them, were much easier to buy land in. Only 6 of them were harder than New Zealand. So we're already at the tougher end of the scale. Secondly, I think they're reflecting sentiment, and all I'm saying to you is that if you look at the reality of what's been sold under a national government, I wouldn't argue it's an excessive amount when you consider it's 72 farms out of 45,000 in 18 months.
Do you don't think you need some kind of rule change?
Well, that's a different issue. I mean, that would depend a lot on what happens and when we finally get advice on what the decision by the courts means in the future, but at this point, look, we'll just run with the law.
Is this Crown Law Office opinion days or weeks away?
I can't answer that question. That's a matter ultimately for the Overseas Investment Office to get that advice, and Crown Lawyers, Overseas Investment Office is working on that. So I don't know exactly when Crown Law will provide them advice.
Saying it would be only a matter of days.
Yeah, no, I saw them say that, and look, that may be possible, but I've had certainly no advice that they've either received advice from Crown Law what their opinion is, and I would have thought they would want to take their time to carefully consider that.
Yeah, wouldn't that indicate that they underestimated the strength of the judgment and the way the parties reacted to that judgment, if they thought they could do it within days, and in fact it looks like it's going to take longer for me, much longer than days?
Well, you really need to refer those questions to the OIO. I don't want to speak for them, but just in terms of what I saw them say, my interpretation of it, I think they were arguing it would be a relatively quick process because the number of areas where they need to reconsider the application under the new ruling is quite small. I think it was only 4. So basically, I think what the OIO is saying, we've done all the preparatory work, we can go and have a look at the test now, the new test, and apply it. That's quite a quick process. My point is, that physical assessment might be quite quick, but what everyone needs to hold their breath for a moment and try and understand is, what does the new law absolutely mean? Because just as they were judicially reviewed previously, there would be nothing stopping someone judicially reviewing a future decision. So I believe it's very important that both ministers and the Overseas Investment Office fully understand what Justice Miller was saying last week, and what that now means for the appropriate test after the law.
But on the face of it, would you agree that Justice Miller has effectively tightened the test?
That's my read of it, but yeah, obviously I'm not a lawyer, and we're seeking an opinion on that. But on balance, it looks to me as if it's a tightening.
So, what do you think about the IO now having to compare the Penge Invent to a hypothetical New Zealand investment? Does that rhyme to you at all?
Well, that's the judge's ruling of the way he believes that the test should be interpreted. I mean, what is clear is that both Labor and National, as governments, ever since this was the law in 2005, have consistently considered applications under the old before and after test of benefits. That's now changed, with or without. And, I mean, it depends on your ruling. If you have a read of the judgment, what the judgment basically says is he doesn't think it should be a complex counterfactual. He actually says it's somewhat subjective, and it's not absolutely clear whether he expects a massive Excel spreadsheet to be concocted and put together and compared to a hypothetical bid. He just says, it's a bit more subjective.
Are you
comfortable if it is tightened?
Yeah, are you comfortable if the interpretation is that it's been tightened? Are you comfortable with the message it sends abroad?
Well, what I care about is that it's, we understand it, so that the Overseas Investment Office can make sure it provides the right advice to government, and that ministers accurately understand the law, so that when they are deciding on an application, they're applying the law as now the courts intend. Outside of that, all I hear is it's consistent. I don't pick winners in terms of who buys assets and who doesn't. I just want to make sure people comply with the law. That's our obligation as the government.
Do you think the office should take into account, when it's looking at those benefits, the impact on the current account deficit? Because obviously if you have a foreign buyer with land versus a New Zealand buyer, one's going to add to the current account deficit, the other's going to presumably reduce it.
Yeah, I think it depends. That's a complex question, isn't it? Because it depends on how the domestic purchaser will fund his or her investment. I mean, if it's foreign borrowings, it's possible actually to also affect the current account deficit. So it depends on a number of different factors. But look, on balance, we'll just work with the law as it's prescribed, as we work our way through.
Is there an argument, sort of following on from that, about making the OIO a bit more dynamic and maybe a bit more strategic? And for argument's sake, would they not belong somewhere better, like DMED, rather than under Land Information in New Zealand? I mean, does it not seem...
Well, I don't have any advice on that. And I think you wouldn't want to make a radical change to the Overseas Investment Office on the basis of their interpretation of the benefits test in the Overseas Investment Act. I mean, at the end of the day, the Overseas Investment Office, when this law was put together by a previous Labor government, sought, one would assume, a Crown Law view of how that should be interpreted, and that followed that consistently for 7 years. It's not unusual for the courts to come out and give a different interpretation of the law away from what everyone understood. Last year, I stood before you and had this debate about covert filming, when the Supreme Court changed the interpretation of when that was legal and when it wasn't. Some years earlier, Helen Clark stood before you and had the same discussion after the courts interpreted differently whether the foreshore and seabed was in fact in Crown ownership.
So do you think this will pass the test?
Don't know. It's not for me to say. I simply don't know. It's a matter of the IO.
But once your lawyers have decided what you think the judgment means, and it's the application is submitted again...
Yep.
Would you see a need to change the law to reflect the judgment, or will you let the judgment stand as separate law?
Well, notwithstanding, I mean, what I've said and what I said last week was I think it's unlikely that there would be an appeal, and that's the same position today. It's unlikely, not impossible. That would be a matter that Crown Law is currently considering, but it's unlikely that there would be an appeal.
So you need to clarify that just in...
Well, the process to go through is the Overseas Investment Office needs to understand how they should interpret the law, and I think ministers need to be absolutely crystal clear that they are they understand fully what the legal position is as well.
Would you consider changing the law though to make it clear that it's the position that you thought it was?
Well, I think what we would prefer to do in the first instance is get a legal opinion of what this ruling actually means. Because I've read the judgment now on a couple of occasions, and as I say, if you go back and look, I think it's paragraph 39 of the judgment, he actually doesn't say, when he says it's a with or without test, that it's, he accepts Crown Law's position that it's actually quite complex to work out a counterfactual bid. And you've got to remember, at the moment, he's actually saying that the IO should consider a counterfactual bid that hasn't actually been lodged. So that is an interesting position to be in.
What makes you confident that the IO is capable of making that judgment? Because it's staffed by lawyers and there's no economic or business plan.
Well, it's a legal interpretation, isn't it? I mean, at the end of the day, Crown Law are going. Well, it's an economic benefits test as understood by the law or dictated by the law. So the previous test was a before and after test, which is it's a legal interpretation of an economic benefit. And what Justice Miller is saying is that legal interpretation, in his view, was flawed, and that it should have been a with or without test.
Couldn't an appeal clarify that? Exactly what the law means?
Well, it could do, but if in the first instance, I think we need to satisfy ourselves that we understand what the new ruling means, what impact that's likely to have, and decide whether we think an appeal is warranted. I mean, that is possible, but as I said, you know, I remain of the view that it's unlikely. I'm just saying we haven't had an opinion from Crown Law yet.
Why is it unlikely? If there is confusion about just what the new rule might be impacted.
Well, the point I think would be that we are uncertain at this time because we haven't actually had a formal opinion. In the fullness of time, we will get that opinion, and that may clarify the position for us. It's just I'm, you know, hesitant to give you a kind of bush lawyer's view of it when, you know, the Crown Law will give us one.
Once you're at the point where the OIO and the ministers all agree on what the judgment means,
yes,
will you share it or get them to share it with the applicant and the vacant so that everyone has the same understanding?
Well, I'm not sure it would be dealt with in that way, although that's possible. I think it's important that everybody understands, actually, not uniquely the FAE Consortium or Shanghai Pengjin, that they understand fully the rules. I think everyone needs to understand it, because one of the most important things when it comes to foreign investment is that there is some degree of predictability and transparency. I think they're the two key factors that foreigners are looking for. And so one possible option is that Crown Law obviously provides an opinion to the Overseas Investment Office, and that ministers seek that to be peer-reviewed. I'm not ruling it out.
On the issue of the this infectious diseases survey, it shows that if poor, you're nearly three times more likely to be hospitalised in rich neighbours. Does that concern you?
Yes, and I mean, at most basic level, it's why the government's putting more money into rheumatic fever. It's why we've been insulating so many homes around New Zealand. It's why we're trying to lift people out of poverty and get them back into work, because more often than not, if they're in poverty, they may well be trapped on welfare. And that's why we've established a ministerial committee on poverty. Now, I think we're a first world country, and we don't expect New Zealanders to be contracting third world diseases.
When would you expect to see some kind of change in surveys and results like that?
Look, that's a very difficult question to answer. I mean, in terms of rheumatic fever, I think we can address that, you know, relatively quickly, although I hasten to add that's likely to be a symptom of very poor housing, and so you do need to go back and address the housing issues rather than just putting money into rheumatic fever. But that's one of the things the Ministerial Committee on Poverty will certainly consider.
So would you expect next time that we saw survey results like that, they would be better than they are now?
I think we'd certainly hope they would be, but I think we all need to acknowledge that these levels of deprivation have been apparent in New Zealand for quite a long period of time, and we need to work on addressing those as quickly as we can.
Last week, the Salvation Army had sent a report talking about the way in Auckland, in particular, fresh housing has lagged well behind population growth, and they see that as one of the main drivers of child poverty and these infectious diseases. I know there's limited scope for new spending in the budget this year, but would you see affordable new housing as being something that you think should have a priority?
Well, I have some sympathy actually for the view that there could be a real housing shortage, particularly in Auckland. I think there are a number of factors that potentially are driving that issue at the moment. The failure of the finance companies is actually causing one of those issues, because it's more difficult for developers to get access to finance. There are issues around planning and ultimately the spatial plan in Auckland that will need to be resolved. And I think specifically in terms of very low income people, one of the reasons why we're embarking on things like the Tamaki redevelopment is to try and make sure that we do address that very critical nature of those in need. It's one of the reasons why we think reviewable tenancies is the right way to go, to make sure that the worst cases and those in greatest need are being prioritised. We're also looking to work potentially with that social sector, the third sector, to start providing social housing. And I think we've got some ideas of how we might be able to lubricate that system.
Given the Salvation Army was stressing the need for urgency, and going back to that question about whether there's scope for notwithstanding what you've mentioned, yeah. Whether there's scope in the budget for new and enforceable power to spend, is there? I mean, do you see that reflect the urgency that the government feels about this issue?
Well, there's no question that things are very tight when it comes to the budget, but on the other side of the coin, it's an important issue. And it might be just the way that we operate in that space. I know certainly the Housing Minister and the Minister of Finance have been of the view that if we work constructively with social providers, we may be able to get much better results quite quickly. And they've been quite innovative, whether it's Housing for Communities, Salvation Army, others, where we might be able to really both maximise the stock that we've currently got and create more stock. And that's something I know that they'll actively be working with that sector on.
$1 million for the Diamond Jubilee, specifically what will that be spent on?
Yeah, so firstly, Sir Don McKinnon will hopefully raise more money from other New Zealanders, and it's used in developing Commonwealth countries to celebrate the Diamond Jubilee and to try and help those countries, you know, which are in greatest need. So it's a sort of gift to developing countries.
So what do you mean? Do you mean celebrating it, or do you mean in terms of aid?
Well, it's a celebration of the Diamond Jubilee. And as a result of that, you know, countries are the wealthier countries in the Commonwealth have agreed to raise money under Sir John Major, and that will be used in developing countries for projects of great need.
What sort of projects, and how can you make sure in some of those countries that the money's being directed into the areas that's needed?
Well, I can't answer the latter question, but one would assume, given the high-profile nature of the resources that are likely to be raised and the significant amount that will be raised, I understand the Australian government, for instance, put in $5 million. So, you know, right around the world, I'm sure Commonwealth countries will be putting in substantial resources. In terms of the earlier stuff, I mean, there are many, you know, emerging countries and Commonwealth countries which are in real need. So I think there are lots of projects, whether it's housing or water, you know, farmland and irrigation, all of those things, about building sustainability for those countries.
There's a report in the Herald, I think, this morning that Treasury might be looking at investor loyalty schemes for these SOE shares. What's your view on this? Do you think you need them?
Well, it's certainly true that Treasury has sought advice on a wide range of issues when it comes to, you know, the mixed ownership model, and certainly true that they've had discussions or gone to Queensland. Whether we actually need loyalty or bonus schemes is something that the Cabinet hasn't had an opportunity to consider yet. It's a possible device, although we expect the demand to be quite high for these shares. So I'm not ruling it out, I just haven't considered all the options, but I know Treasury have gone away to look at a wide range of potential options.
But it seems probably not. Have you had any sort of discussions?
We're going to offer a view on one or the other.
Right. And is Cabinet talking about wholesale reform to local government sector and how that's run?
So it's in the fullness of time, Cabinet will be considering changes in local government. We'll need to go and talk to that sector and engage with them. But what is true is the incoming Minister, Nick Smith, is concerned in a number of areas. He's voiced some of those concerns. He's particularly concerned about the rate increases and the compound nature of those over the last 7 or 8 years. He's certainly keen to make sure that local government can be effective and efficient and work hand in glove with the government's economic development ambitions and wider ambitions for the community. So there will be proposed changes, but we haven't finalised those changes yet.
So what kind of changes are you looking at in the draft sense?
Well, there's potentially a range, but we certainly still continue to do that work. We haven't actually settled on what we think our ambition will be yet.
Amalgamation of district councils?
All I can say around amalgamation is that, you know, I stand by what we campaigned on, which is we won't force amalgamation, but we do think amalgamation, for instance, in Auckland has been successful.
Rates caps?
Don't go into particular bits today.
You might have caught up with Bill English's quotes at the BPS last week when he said the proceeds figures were not best guesses, just guesses.
Right.
Is that an accurate?
Well, I think they're our best estimates. So the way I would describe that is there are lots of variables in there. And there's variables in terms of what we do know is that the Crown will absolutely have a minimum of 51% shareholding, but could have more. We don't know exactly what the price the market will pay at the time. We don't know the exact timing of all of these particular floats. The initial estimates were between 5 and 7 billion, and the advice I've had is it's pretty much in the middle there, around about 6, as I said a couple of weeks ago. So I'm confident of those numbers as best you can be. But his basic point is there's a degree of subjectivity there because of the variables and moving parts, just as there is when we put together any set of budget predictions. In the end, you know, they rely on a certain amount of best analysis that you can get.
Could it be a case of you not wanting to give your best estimates because you don't want to give too much away on the commercial side?
No, I mean, look, there's some of the early work is obviously commercially confidential, but in broad terms, you know, it's around about that $6 billion our anticipated market. But it will depend on a number of factors. I mean, we could do, for instance, take Mighty River Power, we could sell 49% in one tranche, but we could also have a couple of tranches. You know, we could ultimately decide that, you know, we don't want to rush on Air New Zealand, for instance, if we think the international airline market's weak. So there's just a number of factors there, but overall the direction is clear, and I think in broad terms the amount of money we'll raise is clear.
The savings and finance costs that you get from the SSA program are exceeded by the foregone profits by up to $100 million a year. How is that good economics?
Yeah, so basically, firstly, if you look at the financing costs that you don't have to meet because you're not raising money versus the dividends that you get, it's about a wash but slightly net cash positive for the Crown. What is true is that the retained earnings that those corporations would keep on their balance sheet is slightly negative for the Crown, but it's worth remembering a couple of things. Firstly, we pick up some of that when in the anticipated price when the IPO is done, and secondly, we're effectively de-risking the Crown balance sheet, so there is ultimately some premium paid for the commercial risks that we as the owner currently have. And that's true of any owner, and go and ask people what happened to their stock price and their portfolio after the stock market crash and various times.
Bill English said last week that getting into this joint ownership thing means that the Crown would probably have to become a more active owner and possibly likely put capital in, and Tony Rowell repeated that in Parliament. So, in fact, from what they were saying, it appears that the call on government capital may increase.
But it wouldn't increase on a net basis. In other words, if we were hypothetically released $6 billion worth of capital, we won't be having a capital injection of $6 billion. But what is possible is that, for instance, if we were to sell 49% of Mighty River Power and they were then to go and want to expand, for instance, their geothermal capability in another part of the world, there could be a call on the shareholder. Now, again, that's not unusual. Meridian already did that when they purchased Southern Hydro. So there are lots of ways that might happen. Crown, for instance, you know, always reserves the right to make a capital injection as it's done with things like Kiwi Bank.
Mr. Key, you know, you may have seen the comments from Stephen Fry about the New Zealand's broadband services, specifically telecoms. How can New Zealanders have confidence that your $1.5 billion investment in ultra-fast broadband will result in a world-class service, given telecom's record of telecom or spin-off has such a large control over this making that investment?
Well,
on its behalf, and has this record of exploiting its market?
Well, my understanding in terms of, and I don't normally get myself into worrying about individual consumers and their broadband speeds, but if I was to delve in the weeds for just a moment, my understanding is that the issue for Stephen Fry was nothing to do with the network, it was his data cap. So once that data cap was actually lifted, then he's going to get faster speeds. But anyway, putting that all to one side, I think we're all prepared to accept that ultra-fast broadband will ultimately deliver a better service for him, because, you know, it's 100 megs up and down, as opposed to what he's currently operating on. It's probably between five and ten meters. It's might even be less, depending on where he's operating his broadband from. So basically, the long and short of it is putting the operator to one side. The technology that comes from the ultra-fast broadband upgrade unquestionably will deliver a better, faster service. It comes at a price, but I don't think that's been the issue that's been driving the problem for Stephen Fry today.
Stephen Fry did set the record straight, but it would have been when most of his UK followers were fast asleep. Are you worried that this could take our reputation at all, given he's got so many followers and also influential?
Well, if he set the record straight, I'm sure it'll be fine.
Do you think he needs another gadget, something that will sort of ring an alarm bell when his data cap is ready?
I just don't know enough about what he's got on his computer, so I'll leave it to him to sort out, or I'm sure the nice people at Telecom will come and talk to him, or one of the many competitors in New Zealand.
Just going back to Christchurch for a second, are there any residual issues to be resolved with the reinsurers before the rebuilding of Christchurch can begin in earnest?
Well, I think it's fairer to characterise it as a work in progress. We're constantly talking to through the insurance council, directly to the reinsurers. I've seen a number of reports on that, and progress is being made, but that doesn't mean the situation's absolutely perfect. It just means that I think they are feeling a higher degree of confidence about Christchurch. And my understanding in the most recent report I read, that generally the reinsurers weren't deterred by the earthquake that took place on the 23rd of December, and that's good news. The fear was it might set the process back a little bit, but apparently they haven't been overly concerned about that.
More mindful of the anniversary, can you give us any idea of what the sticking points are and when a reasonable time frame for when they will be resolved? Because that's what people on Wednesday will be looking for.
Look, I think the bigger issue overall has been, one, insurers have wanted the seismic activity to start calming down to feel a high degree of confidence. The second broad issue for Cantabrians has simply been the price they're having to pay for insurance. And thirdly, you've seen some people exiting the market. So there's a combination of different issues there. But I mean, again, the reports I get is that increasingly people are being able to access insurance through the normal markets, and they are operating. It's just not perfect.
So the time frame would be by the end of this year or early next year? What are you working with?
Well, I think at one level you can see by the fact that, you know, the numbers I read out, that there's quite a lot of construction activity already happening that people are getting insurance for. So to a certain degree the market is working, but I'd be the first to acknowledge that there's room for improvement. I think that'll happen over time as the situation calms down a bit there.
As Tourism Minister, Mr. Key, are you concerned by the EU's decision to include airlines in its emissions trading scheme?
Well, the only thing I'd sort of say is that, you know, that was the, they've already been, I don't know if they've been included in their system, but certainly there's been a number of attempts to try and price in emissions from airlines. And that was really the basis of the argument for the departure tax that the UK applied. Now, we got our Treasury to really rip those numbers apart and diffuse, if you like, the myth that this was really about actually paying for climate change, and was fundamentally just a revenue collecting exercise, and that's what it is. So at one level, if that system was fair, it might be worthy of having a look at, but I'd need to go and look at it and look at what they're actually doing, what their phase out is and the time frame.
There's an annual Sentinel events. There's increase in falls this year, and the nurses organisation is saying that it's a direct result of not having enough adequately skilled and qualified nursing staff. What do you make of that?
Well, I haven't analysed that. I've had a brief look at the data, and it looked to be fairly consistent one year to the next. We work hard, I think, to provide a great service for New Zealanders, and the vast bulk of them get a tremendous service when they go to hospital. I can have nurses directly raising it with me that's been an issue, maybe an issue they've raised with the DHBs or with the minister, and you need to take that with them. But, you know, we try and make sure that our nurses are well trained, and I think they provide a great service for New Zealanders.
And broadly with that report, you're pretty comfortable?
Well, at one level it's indicating, you know, more than one New Zealander a day is the victim of a Sentinel, a serious event. Having said that, it needs to be seen in the context of a very large number of people going through the hospital and tertiary system. And I think the most important thing is we have transparency in the system, and the reason why I think those reports are important is not to frighten people when they go into hospital, but to make sure that DHBs and hospitals learn from mistakes that might have occurred and seek to make sure that they're not replicated. Okay, thank you.